Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focused Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you're tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we have out there on the internet. Go to focuscompounding.com to get access to investment write-ups from Jeff going all the way back to 2005. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. And of course, be sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening or watching us here today so you will be notified whenever we upload a podcast in the future. We are on the air on Mondays and Wednesdays, and we will be in print on Fridays. That's going to be in the form of a newsletter that we're not going to charge for. We say we shouldn't call it a newsletter because you typically charge for that. So we're going to call it a not a newsletter thing that we're going to push out into the universe. We haven't come up with a name for it yet. But Jeff, are you what do you have cooked up for everybody for this week's print edition from Focus Compounding?
Well, the first things will be two net nets and a Japanese trading company.
It's going to be on our website, focuscompounding.com, for free. And I'm also going to tweet it out. So you can go and read it by Twitter or from our website, Focus Compounding. But I'm also going to put the link in the description as well. One thing that we also should talk about as well, we do follow a lot of what you would call event-driven things, insider transactions, spin-offs, large purchases by companies, C-suite changes, stuff like that. I tweet out often just different things that I come across that I think are interesting. One way to keep track of all of that is by going to insiderarbitrage.com. And it's a good way that really aggregates all this data into one place where you could just track all this stuff, and especially like mergers and acquisitions and stuff like that. So if you want to sign up for it, we do have a affiliate link in the description as well. I use it often. It's a great way to track everything. And if anyone wants to get access to that or check out the website, click that link in our description, insiderarbitrage.com. So in today's podcast, we are going to be talking about Japanese trading companies, which ties in perfectly to what you are going to write about that will be sent out tomorrow. And specifically, we want to talk about why Buffett invested in Japanese trading companies. So from a press release, actually from an article from July that talks a little bit about this, because Buffett increased his stake. It says Berkshire Hathaway on Monday said its wholly owned subsidiary, National Indemnity, has increased its stake in five Japanese trading firms to average more than 8.5%. The companies involved are Itochu, Marubeni, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, and Sumitomo. Apologize for the mispronunciation, but this total investment is one of Buffett's or Berkshire's largest investment in any country outside of the United States. Berkshire Hathaway said it intends to hold its Japanese investments for the long term, with CEO Warren Buffett pledging the company will only purchase up to 9.9% of any of the five firms. So we're going to talk about those five firms here today, Jeff. Before we do that, why do you think Buffett was interested in Japan? Now the consensus is people are focusing more on Japan, but again, Buffett went there by himself first, and now a lot more people are starting to look for value in Japan. But why do you think he started with Japan, right? How has his international investing evolved over the years? Has he invested in Japan before? He did own Taiwan Semiconductor, which he did sell, which if you listen to this year's Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting event, the impression he gave off was there was what he thought could be catastrophic risk potentially with TSM. But just want to hear your thoughts on investing in Japan. Why do you think Buffett went there? And then we could dive into the trading companies.
Right. So first, to make clear, the write-up that I have will be of another trading company, not among that list. There are seven what they call general trading companies. These are English translations of concepts in Japanese. And so basically, this, like if you look at the Japan Company Handbook or something, they'll categorize these, or Wikipedia, I think, will categorize them. And they put them in a group, sort of like we had investment banks or something. And, you know, it's not an exact thing, but this, the five that you mentioned will always be mentioned together. There's a couple smaller ones that often will be mentioned too. And the write-ups of the smallest one up, right? So starting with the smallest ones and then moving up, seeing if these annual reports are enough to write something about. So I think he probably got the Japan Company Handbook. So he has invested in Korea before, personally. And he said that he had Citigroup send him stuff on Korea. That's the Japan Company Handbook, yeah. And he had invested in China, but that's a very large company, PetroChina, so he probably found that without having to look at things in China. And as you said, he invested in Taiwan Semiconductor, but that's something he would have known about from other companies in the U.S., and it's owned by hedge funds and things in the U.S. and everything. So it's well-known stock, and it just happens to be that it's in Taiwan. This one he probably found by looking specifically at Japanese stocks. I suspect that he used the Japan Company Handbook just because I think there have been pictures in the past of the Japan Company Handbook on his desk. It would be the kind of resource he would use if, you know, I have some old Moody's manuals and stuff. And it's very, very similar to that kind of thing. It's what Buffett would like when he says flipping through things. So it has a paragraph description. It has some key information that you'd have. The closest thing we have today is like Value Line or something. There's not any resource in the U.S. that's as good as the Japan Company Handbook for Japan, just for doing what Buffett would do, where you can start in the front and go through the whole thing, which I do, and it takes a long time. It's a quarterly book, but I only buy it usually once a year. And people have asked how to do that. You know, there are ways to get it in the U.S. that aren't that difficult, but I actually just opened an Amazon Japan account as the easiest way to reliably get it without having to pay high prices. And that's probably how he did it. And then also what's useful about that book is that it classifies things together, because in Japan, as a lot of Asian markets, they use numbers for tickers instead of letters, and they try to put certain things that are associated with each other together, kind of how in the U.S. they tend to try to cluster earnings releases. So you'll see companies say, we're moving our earnings up a week or back or whatever to better align with other companies. So like all the investment banks or something would release near each other. Well, in something like Japan, companies that are similar will be listed next to each other, and the book will go through them in order. So it means that by classification, you'll get a lot of the same industries or something, one company after another. So you'll read about like 20 home builders in a row. And that means that you could probably pick up on patterns and things. And then the next thing is these companies put out annual reports in English, or integrated reports, I guess they call them, because there's more than just financial information in them. And some of them, including the smaller trading company, which I'll write about this week, put a lot of effort into the annual report, a lot more effort than often goes into U.S. annual reports. And so a big communications push. So it would be very easy to understand what they say they're going to do and see if they're going to do it. Japanese companies also really like what they call a medium-term plan, which is often like a five-year plan or something. And I had commented in the past that there are big cultural differences that are important to keep track of. So, for instance, with U.S. companies, guidance is very different than guidance in other countries. So, like in China, I believe, generally companies don't meet guidance. They say that what they're going to do, and then like near the time that they get towards what releasing results, they say, oh, we're not going to do that. It's going to be worse. So it's aspirational in that way. In the United States, they tend to go the other way and tell you if they was it Snap, I guess, and some other companies and stuff, had things where they actually warned way ahead of time because they knew that they were going to miss by so much. So normally, if you get close to earnings that you've guided towards in the United States, then you make that and stuff. So in Japan, one thing is they had a history of putting out medium-term guidance for like what our 5 years will be. And they would follow up with it and stuff, but they might miss it and they would still not give a lot of explanation for why they missed it or something. So sometimes there was questions about whether they were serious about something. And that could include something like a return on equity goal or something. Because in the United States, it would be less common to do that, right? You wouldn't necessarily put a goal and then mention each year what the goal is. And then just say, you know, our goal was to do 10% or something. You do 8% and you still put it in your report. In the U.S., they probably just like change their goals to take it out and stuff so that they didn't have that embarrassment. Buffett likes that kind of thing. I think we know that from Occidental, their capital plans and things. But IBM, a big reason he bought was probably their like 5-year plan or something. So I think that's very common that he buys based on that. And they're very explicit about it in some of their annual reports. So, for instance, the one that I was talking about, which is one of the smallest, says straight up, we haven't met our goal. Our stock trades below book value. Our stock needs to trade consistently above book value or at book value, they mean. To do that, we need to achieve a high enough return on equity. And it goes on for paragraphs about that, which is not common in the United States. That, you know, no companies that trade below book value, no net nets or anything, talk about return on equity, talk about goals, think it's a bad thing that they trade below book value. They just don't talk about it. And in Japan, they're talking about it.
Mm-hmm. So why trading companies? Why do you think he started there? I mean, do you want to first explain what a trading company is? I mean, when I think about investing in a trading company, I think about basically you're investing in their economy.
Okay. So there's really no way to explain what a trading company is. It's not a concept that makes sense in the United States. The words in Japanese aren't exactly what we're using here and don't mean the same thing. There's a whole history to them. And it's very cultural in comparison to U.S. business culture versus Japanese business culture and why these even exist and everything. They're very strange to American ears. I think they're somewhat less strange to the ears of people from other countries where some things like this might exist in a little, might be closer to existing. So today, as these companies exist and when Buffett invested in them, I would say they're most similar to Berkshire Hathaway, private equity, groups of companies that private equity controls, which is different because private equity, you know, has a firm that charges a fee and all that. And so we don't see it. But like, if you actually saw what private equity owns and stuff, they're very similar to these kinds of companies. And then, and Berkshire is a conglomerate, and conglomerates used to be more common in the US. And then some people would say there's some similarities to like investment banks and stuff. I don't see that as much. I see it more similar to private equity and Berkshire itself. I think he definitely reading it was like, oh, this is a lot like Berkshire. The history is that these are development companies, basically. We say trading, so it makes it sound like it's import-export purely, but really it's providing capital and other assistance to companies, especially companies that are dealing with investments in other countries and trying to open up business in another country or trying to source products, commodities and things from another country and bring it in. This isn't that common to do this kind of thing in the United States, but it happens from time to time. So like there's a mine in Nevada, which actually will be operated. Actually, like the actual mining operation part will be done by NACO, but the mine is owned by Lithium Americas, and they are got an investment that's complex and stuff from General Motors. And part of that deal is that General Motors will get access to the lithium. That kind of deal of what General Motors is doing themselves is sort of what some of these companies were built on years ago. So, you know, and they talk about their history, but say you're... So you work with textile companies. I mean, the textile companies one is a little different because they're trading companies that specialize in textiles. Like as you go through the Japan Company Handbook, there'll be sections. These are general trading companies and are classified differently than ones that are focused entirely on a single industry. They also tend to separate out those that are part of a larger group. Sometimes there's one that's debatable. That's a Toyota one, for instance, but some of the others are kind of separated for that reason. That's not all that they do though. Like I said, if you read through Japan Company Handbook, you're going to see a lot of things that are recapitalizations of smaller companies that are done by these companies. So that's the, whether you want to call it private equity aspect to it or the Berkshire aspect, basically special deals to do these things. And there's going to be situations where they merge things together. There's even situations related to tying them into a larger IT thing or a larger advertising thing. So those aren't purely foreign and domestic things. There's a lot of things where you say affiliates of this company work with that. And that's why I say that it's similar to private equity, because private equity seems to do that kind of thing a lot. Tying up groups within their larger ownership. Go work with this company, go work with that one. And a lot of times it's the company that they're recapitalizing and stuff doesn't feel that they have expertise in doing this. But if we're talking about the history of these companies, yeah, 100 years ago, even longer, they, you know, say we need cotton from India, we need coal from Vietnam, whatever the things they needed. And you don't really know how to do that. Let's provide capital. Let's build a plant there. Let's have partial ownership of things. And then let's source it for you. And so the returns on equity and all that might be bad sometimes, because the focus might be specifically on securing natural resources or other imports. Japan, you know, has basically no natural resources. And secondarily, the kind of the uses of capital and stuff. But the plan now is more towards having a focus on the getting better returns, right? They're all pretty diversified. They're all very diversified, to be honest. So it'll say in things in their annual reports, in Japan Company Handbook, whatever, you know, 30% in minerals or materials or something, 20% in healthcare, 15% in restaurants, you know, whatever. And that's why I say they're like private equity. You know, there's not like an overall operating thing. Then there's other cultural aspects which are hard to tell. I have the perception that they're very desirable employers. I don't know if that's true. Not Japanese. I've been to Japan. But like I said, with investment banks or private equity or something, they probably pay a lot. They probably get a lot of applicants. They probably are considered places that people work and then go to other things and stuff. Certainly, you can see when they talk about employees and stuff from other places that they're dropping in people two small firms that they control or have recapitalized or something who have connections to them from someplace else. Like you'll see that they are basically when something goes wrong at some small company publicly listed, you'll see that. That is a big difference with Japan versus the United States. Companies don't tend to go private. So that's why Japan's very exciting for small caps, because there are about as many micro caps and stuff in Japan as in the United States, maybe more at this point. And that also helps us see this. A lot of these companies have publicly traded, or, you know, partially publicly traded companies, or they were traded and then they're private. So it's much more transparent than like private equity. We can actually see them and get valuations on them. And that's also how we know things about, like where I said that we know they've dropped in a CEO somewhere or something. It's because these are publicly traded companies. And so they mention that. They say, you know, they give the background of who their new CEO is, and look, it's from their new big shareholder or something.
Mm-hmm. So Buffett originally invested in the five trading companies in August of 2020. Let's walk through what he may have been looking at and what piqued his interest from like a quantitative perspective. I mean, how did he get comfortable, you think, with investing in Japan? I mean, I guess opposite to you, he has been to Japan and probably understands the culture, but I mean, he clearly understands the culture in America more than he would in Japan. So I'm just curious to get your thoughts on how do you think he got comfortable with investing in these five trading companies, and what do you think he saw?
The only complaint I've ever heard from Buffett about Japan is that the returns on equity are too low, which is true. So historically, Japan, before the bubble and everything, if we go back to the 80s and everything, still had lousy returns on equity. It's similar to China. It's very, very similar to China in many ways. And so even though people liked it, and you know, the Chinese stock market, I don't think has had good returns for 20 years or something, but the Japanese stock market did before the bubble burst. But the actual returns of its companies were not that great. So if you comped U.S. companies versus Japanese companies, I think Japan at that time had like the most valuable bank, the most valuable telecom, by market capitalization, but by profitability, return on assets, actual profits, all that stuff, it didn't compare as in any way better than U.S. companies, their biggest ones. And that was common throughout. They used a lot of debt and stuff. And so that was disguised somewhat. So sometimes return on equity would look okay, even though the return on capital, return on assets was poor, cash flow was poor. So years ago in the 90s or something, Buffett was asked about Japan, and basically he said, you know, the returns on equities are 4% or whatever, and if I think I can get 4% somewhere else, then I don't want to do that. There are two reasons why he might invest in Japan now. One is he can borrow in yen. They did borrow, and that was very cheap. Two, the yen is just very cheap versus the dollar. So if you wanted to use dollars and convert them over and then invest that way and take a risk on it, you could do that. But the third one is that the returns on equity of Japanese stocks are somewhat higher than they used to be. But more importantly, probably the prospective forward returns on U.S. stocks and other markets, he understands, is a lot lower. So Japan is much more relatively attractive. Obviously, you know, the mediocre businesses, average businesses bought at decent prices become a lot more exciting if the returns you expect in other things are low. So they become, you know, they're less exciting if you don't. But if you're thinking, oh, I can lock in 10% returns here, locking in 10% returns is a lot more exciting if you're having trouble finding those kinds of things in other markets, and he seems to be.
How do you think he could get to that 10% return, right? So if you look at ITOCHU, currently where it's trading is about 10 times earnings, EV to free cash flow about 12 times. If you look at a stock chart of this, I did say he purchased these companies in August of 2020. So the return, it's basically doubled, right? So is that come from multiple expansion?
Right. So there's a few things. One, if you're looking in yen, then it's good results.
Yeah.
Two is they've generally out. So obviously the yen has gone down a lot versus the dollar. The dollar's gone out versus everything, but the yen in particular has been really bad. So in yen terms, and they finance this with yen or a lot of it with yen, he's vastly outperformed other markets. Like, this is way better than other things he could have invested in. He's probably saw a few things with it. One, price to book is less than one at these companies. Two, these companies use debt. And debt's basically free in Japan. So if you notice throughout the Japan Company Handbook, companies that are willing to borrow and invest in assets with decent returns in Japan have incredible returns on equity sometimes. These don't necessarily have all that high. They're okay. But it's pretty common throughout Japan that you see that. So you could have a 5% return on assets, but in the U.S. now, capital is going to cost you more than that. But in Japan, it's nearly free. They have large dividends, right? And then some companies are doing other things to improve their returns on capital, which includes selling cross holdings, buying back stock, and doing other sorts of things. So they, all of them pretty much have a stated goal to get their return on equity up and stuff. There's even some sort of semi-regulatory stuff that includes kind of disclosures, plans, talking about why your stock trades below book and how you're going to improve it.
What is the trading company you were going to write up? Perhaps we could look at it here today on QuickFS.
So it's SOJITZ.
Okay. Here we go. Conglomerate. Yep.
But there's no reason to write it up other than I'm just starting with smaller companies and moving up the list.
Okay.
So the problem with the Buffett ones is they're very large, right? And the advantage is he can't invest in some of them. He's bought all five that might have meaning in terms of size of the company. They're very liquid. You can get in and out of the stocks that he's in, no problem. And so but like I said, there are probably about seven of them normally that you would find on a list. There's others, like I said, that are more debatable, I guess. And then you could start from the bottom and move your way up, which is what I'll do, because there may come a point where I just decide not to cover some of the biggest ones that he has. They're very, very well covered in Japan and around the world.
Mm-hmm. So this is a trading company. It's cheap, less than one times book value, whereas the other ones are trading, some of them now, at least ITOCHU, at like 1.4 times book value, return on equity 8.4, EV to free cash flow 9.5. Did they buy back stock? Do they pay a dividend? What's the story with the stock?
So I, do you have the number there? No, you don't, because it's QuickFS, right?
Yeah. What number do you need?
The ticker number.
Ticker number.
I can find it. It's description here, probably. They're not going to all be in the same exact area of the Here we go.
2768.
Oh, okay. So I can give you a basic description of some of the differences. There are some slight differences here in terms of what industries they're in, which would be the biggest one. So part of the argument that some people might have for Buffett doing this is that it's directly tied to these companies are more materials-based generally than U.S. companies, which is definitely true. Like, I compared them to U.S. private equity, but U.S. private equity doesn't actually own a lot of that kind of thing. And Buffett is interested in that. So the breakdown here that they provide, which is a little misleading maybe because I've read the annual report now, they say consolidated, so metals and minerals resources, 27%. This is Japan Company Handbook's breakdown of the total sales here of Sojitz, 2768. Chemicals, 26%. Foods and agriculture business, 14%. Automotive, 12%. Others, 22%. Overseas sales ratio, 53%. So most of its sales are overseas. It breaks it down differently. So for instance, it said probably under others, it just says others. However, company is the general agent for the aircraft of Boeing, right? So it talks about its aircraft business and stuff, but they explicitly say in this one that they are the general agent for the aircraft of Boeing. So meaning that they facilitate sales of Boeing jets in Japan. The way they say it in the book makes it sound like the reverse of what it is. What they mean is that they are selling on behalf of Boeing in the U.S. I mean, selling on behalf of Boeing in Japan. Boeing is of the U.S. And then it talks about automobiles, which there's some description of that too. Resources, it says owns few interests in resources. That's sort of true. That they're largely coal, that's definitely true. Yeah. So established a policy in 2019 that the company will not gain new interest in principal and decrease that for coal for fuel use to half by 2030. Yes. Vietnam, yes. It describes Vietnam. The company is pretty big in Vietnam. And then there's some slight description of other things. So let's look at the background that we can see here. So these are very top-level background things. But from the Trading Company Handbook, we'll get, I think they give you 4 years of past results. And then they'll give you 2 predicted years or something, usually, something like that. So basically a 5-year result. So if we look at this company as of the time this book was printed... so this book was printed, this is the 2023, this is quarterly for spring of 2023, so this is already like 6 months or something out of date. The operating results, operating profit, net profit, whatever, mostly very stable. So what we would call EBIT or something was, and this will be in trillions of yen, I believe, let's see, yes, this is trillions of yen. 1.8 trillion, 1.7 trillion, 1.6, 2.1, and then they're predicted 2.2 and 2.1. So 1.6 to 2.2, right, is basically what they would have done. And then they have a large amount of borrowings, very large. But based on the market cap and the borrowings that we just talked about together, you're going to get, what is that? Let's see. That gets me to about, yeah, let's see. So... it would have been pretty cheap. I have the trading ranges. It got more expensive. It was really cheap in 2019 and 2010. 2019 and 2020. It is up from its lows of that point by about 20 times. Yeah, mm-hmm. 20 times from the 2019 lows. It was actually higher in 2020 than 2019. Yeah. So I think that is adjusted for a, that must be adjusted for a split, but it may only be a 5-to-1 split, meaning it doubled or something. So price to earnings was 6-to-9 times, 6-to-10 times during that period that I just mentioned, and dividend yield 4.8%. Mm-hmm. Price to book at the time this book was printed would have it at about anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of book value. So, you had a dividend yield of close to 5%. I mean, it was 5% if you bought, you know, at any of the lower prices of the quarter, and book value, you're buying at a discount to it. Return on equity, this has predictions for return on equity to be above 12% in,
yeah, 13.
In next next couple of years. And then you also see the ownership levels. Even one as small as this, and this is a small company, is widely known and widely owned. So small for a trading company. So 32% foreign ownership. That's extremely high for any Japanese stock that I would invest in. And then the other ones are mostly everything I see here, the biggest Japanese banks and especially brokerages. So it's very, very like widely owned as an investment from what that says. When you get to smaller Japanese companies and things, a lot of times you'll see more strategic investments and stuff like that. You don't see that in this company. This was formed by a merger of two trading companies in the last 15 years or so.
So you have improving return on equities, low price to book multiple, low price to earnings multiple, good dividend yield of 5%. Currently, I'm looking at my screen now, about 4% because the stock has gone up a little bit, and growth. Projected growth as well. So you could see how you could easily get to a 10% return in something like this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the carry is just, if he's borrowing in yen, or you're, say, borrowing from your broker in Japan or something, so that you don't have the risk with the currency or whatever, you don't have a difference, I should say, in the currency between the U.S. and Japan, you're getting a yield of like 5% or something. Now, you could argue, look, I can get a yield of 5% in the United States in a money market fund, and I can get in dollars instead of yen. The problem is combining that with a company. In the United States, you often don't have companies that yield as much as like 5% or something. So it makes a lot of sense. If a company like this exists in the United States, you'd be happy to do it. The other thing I think is not just like return equity has been going up or something, but probably more important to Buffett is they have a plan to do this and awareness of it. Whether return equity goes up or down in a lot of years, it's like just based on how your business does. But the idea here is there's a goal for all of them to get their price to book consistently above one, and the way that they view that is that they have to achieve a certain level of return equity. Sometimes it's fairly low what they say. They say, you know, if we get 8% or something, but 8, 10, 12, that's, you know, the numbers that they think. Obviously that companies that trade above book value consistently are at. Truthfully, I don't know if they will trade above those price to book levels and stuff. The stocks have gone up a lot, but they were quite low. Sometimes there's a conglomerate type discount and there's a distrust of Japan by foreign investors for capital allocation. So when you look at Japanese stocks, the more thematic ones, right? The ones that are in some AI thing, some software thing, some healthcare thing, some whatever thing that's very comparable to something in the US are the ones that have the very high multiples. And then the more diversified ones, the things that look more like Berkshire Hathaway or something, are the ones that are really cheap. But the upside, of course, is that you get a wide degree of diversification with these. And the capital allocation, all of that, reading the annual report so far, is okay.
How's the insider ownership in companies like this and just in Japan in general? Does management own a good amount?
No. In Japan, generally, management doesn't own a lot. The small microcap type companies, sometimes they're huge owners and the families are owners. And remember, there's different rules in Japan versus the US. It's much easier to tell when people own stock in the United States. In Japan, sometimes we have to add up a bunch of different people in the family and stuff like that. But yeah, companies that have some history where there's a founder or founding family or something within recent memory that's still involved have more insider ownership. But if you mean, they are increasing the amount of compensation, that's greatly increased. So in the last couple years, the average Japanese CEO, I think, is probably, if we add up everything, making a ton more money than they used to. And it's all from incentive compensation, because they used to not really get incentive compensation. Now they have some, and so some stocks went up and stuff, and they get a big amount of incentive compensation. So that's a change. But yeah, in general, these are widely owned by... You know, if I read through the list of this, it's as if it's all owned by, you know, the Vanguards and State Streets and stuff of the United States. I mean, it's widely owned by a disinterested shareholder base usually, other than like we're talking about Berkshire owning these things. And that's probably why Berkshire gave all the stuff about we're investing in all of them at the same time, what percentage we're going up to, visiting Japan, talking about all that, I think is just all meant to smooth over things so that they don't have a problem with the investment.
Got it. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focused Compounding Podcast. Our new podcast schedule is to be in the air on Mondays and Wednesdays and in print on Fridays. If this is the first time you are joining us, be sure to check out all of our content that we have out there on the internet. The best place to do that is to just follow me on Twitter at Focus Compound. We're using QuickFS on this podcast. If you want to sign up, make sure you tell them that you heard about them from Focus Compounding. I thank everybody so much for all the support, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.